by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got really a fine guest this evening. My gosh, welcome to our program, Harrison Coley.
Thanks for having me on, George. It's great to be here.
Okay, tell our listening audience the subject tonight. We're going to cover a book called Political Ponerology. And Harrison Coley, tell us about yourself first, and then let's get into the book after that.
Sure. Well, my name is Harrison Coley. I'm an editor for Red Pill Press. We're a publishing company that publishes political ponerology. I write for an alternative news website called SOTT.net. That's S-O-T-T. .net, where we cover this kind of stuff. We cover current events, earth changes, weather, all sorts of things, science and technology. But we're one of the few websites that uses ponerology as kind of a basis for our analysis and applying it to what goes on in the world today. And so that's pretty much what I do. I'm an editor. I also write, so you can find my articles on SOTT.net, and they've been carried on several other websites as well, but that's primarily what I write for.
Now, how did this book get first written? Andrew Lobachevsky, is that the author's name?
Yep, Andrew Lobachevsky. He's a Polish psychologist. Fortunately, he died about 6 or 7 years ago. He's from Poland originally, and so he was going to school at the time of, well, at the end of World War II, and after that, when the Soviets and the communists basically took over Poland. And so he was going to school at the time, taking psychology, and that was really the genesis, the start of what eventually became the book, Political Ponerology, because what had happened was, at his school, they all of a sudden received a new teacher in the school. Some of the teachers had been laid off. Earlier before that, the Nazis had actually killed most of the psychologists, the practicing psychologists in the country. So he lived through a pretty rough time, and it was probably a pretty courageous choice to go into psychology at the time after that.
But now he started out under a Nazi regime, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
So many of his fellow researchers or psychologists were eliminated by the Nazis. Okay, then continue on. This is interesting.
Yeah, so what happened was when the communists took control of the country and established the new government, they sent out basically indoctrinators, people to propel the propaganda, and one of them came to the university where Lobachevsky was studying and became a new professor. And the thing was, this guy didn't even have a college education. They didn't even know if he'd graduated high school, but there he was taking the position of a professor in this prestigious university and teaching them kind of anti-scientific concepts and the communist propaganda, and basically trying to convert these students over to the new way of thinking. And Lobachevsky and his colleagues, his students at the time, being students of psychology, they could realize very quickly that this guy was a psychopath. And that kind of got the ball rolling. Knowing this guy's personality, and then connecting that with what was going on in the country at a higher level, at the macro-social level, at the political level, that kind of spurred Andrew's research. And what he found out after that was that there was a whole group of scientists in these Eastern European countries that knew what was going on. They could see that what was happening to their country was primarily a psychological phenomenon. This was something that had to do very deeply with what we call psychopaths. and that they had essentially taken over the country. And it wasn't so much that they were communists, because a psychopath will use any kind of political ideology to gain power. It just happened to be communism at this time and in this place. And so these scientists were working on these issues and studying them, but in total secrecy, because if they would have been found out, they would have been arrested, tortured, killed, any number of things, and all of those things did happen at one point or another to various of these researchers. So Lobachevsky was a member of this group of scientists that were trying to establish scientifically what was going on in this country, basically trying to answer the big questions of why totalitarianism happens, why fascism happens, why bad things happen on such a big scale, when if you talk to the people and you just look at your community around you, chances are the people won't support these kind of things. You won't hear them talking about genocide or wanting to subjugate their own people in this country. There's this disconnect between what the people think and what actually happens. And so Lobachevsky became part of this group of scientists, and they worked all through the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and through various of the communist purges. So, you know, because they had to work in total secrecy, one of the reasons that they worked in total secrecy was that if one of them was arrested, they wouldn't be able to basically rat each other out. So they shared their research with each other anonymously through like middlemen to get the research going, and the idea was to finally create a synthesis of all this information to distribute to all the scientists in these countries. And what happened was, I believe it was in the mid-60s, all of Lobachevsky's contacts dried up. It was probably, you know, most of them were probably arrested, and the guy that was going to write the final report, you know, everyone stopped hearing from him. No one knew where he was. Nothing came of it. So Lobachevsky took it upon himself to compile and write what he had, and which unfortunately probably wasn't everything, because he didn't have everything and he wasn't the guy collecting all the data. But so he eventually wrote the book. Now, that's three other interesting stories, because the first time he wrote the book, he was working in a small village, and he was friendly with the people there, and they warned him that there was going to be a secret police raid coming very quickly, so he had to burn all of his materials. He put it all in the furnace and lost it all, and the police came, and, you know, luckily they didn't find anything. And then, you know, years later he wrote the book again, and he tried to send it off to the Vatican, Poland being a big Catholic country. There was a tourist there, and Lobachevsky trusted him and gave him a copy of the book to take to the Vatican to try to get it distributed to the wider world. But nothing ever came of that. He never heard back from the guy. You know, obviously the book didn't make it anywhere because no one ever heard of it. And then third time, Lobachevsky had already been arrested a few times. Most people who are arrested in these countries at least once in their lives, you wouldn't have a family member who hadn't been arrested. And so he had been arrested and tortured two or three times. And then the last time he got arrested, he had been actually denounced by a journalist for Radio Free Europe. Now, Radio Free Europe was the CIA and I believe it was the State Department run. It's still operating, but back then it was this, started out as a CIA operation, to kind of counter the communist propaganda, but at the same time to give the Western propaganda into the Soviet bloc countries. And this guy, for whatever reason, had denounced him to the Polish authorities. So they arrested him again, confiscated all his materials, but this time they gave him a choice. They said, we can either, you'll either spend the rest of your life in prison, or we'll give you your visa, and basically you have to leave the country. So at that point he said, okay, well, I'll leave the country, and he went to New York. And in New York, that's where he finally wrote the book, as we know it, Political Ponderology. Without any of his materials, he basically had his memory only to write it. And so he wrote the book in 1984, 1985, and he corresponded with Zbigniew Brzezinski, that was, you know, Jimmy Carter's ex-national security advisor, And at first, Brzezinski was very positive about the book. It had been translated into English by a colleague of Olduszewski's in New York. And Brzezinski wanted to see it published. And then, for some reason, Brzezinski just kind of stopped contacting him. Olduszewski thinks that it was on purpose, that he had basically squashed the project and made sure that it couldn't be published. For reasons that will hopefully become clear as we talk about it today. But so then for 20 years, the book was unpublished. He'd left a few copies at some universities in New York, but with no publisher, he just sat there until in about 2005, he found our website and saw that we were talking about psychopathy and the effects of psychopathy on culture and politics. And so he contacted us. He contacted the creator of our website, Laura Knight Yadchik, and he said, I've got this book. You want to check it out? And so she read it. We read it. And we're just amazed at how extensive, how detailed, and how accurate this book was about what not only what has gone on in 20th century history and politics, but what's going on right now. And it kind of just made everything so clear. So we published it back then, 2005. It was a journey of 60 years, and he finally got to see it published within his life. So we were very glad to be able to do that for Olduszewski and to bring this book to the world.
Right. I had been reading your old site, the Sign of the Times, SOTT.net.
Yeah, that's
for a number of years, and after y'all had published, then I picked up on it about that time, and there was an extensive article you had on that site, I believe.
Yeah, we've got several on there.
Yeah.
We've got an interview with Olduszewski that we did right around the time we published the book. Laura Knight Yadchik has several articles up there with long excerpts from the book, and I wrote a series of articles called Ponderology 101, where I get into some of the some of the research that ties into ponderology that we have here, in North America and Europe, and the kind of the latest research that ties into the stuff that he was writing about. So listeners can, they just go onto SOT.net. There's a little search bar. You can put in ponderology. You can search my name, Harrison Kaley, K-O-E-H-L-I, and find my articles on there. They're all up there.
Okay. Now, Let's tell our listening audience a little bit. Could we define this psychopath characteristics a little bit better so that there are people out there not even familiar with that term, probably. But how would you define that in real clear terms?
Yeah, and I realized first time I said the word, for people who haven't read a lot about it or heard a lot about it, it'll probably give a wrong impression. Now, a psychopath isn't necessarily like a mad serial killer or someone that's insane. We might get the impression of a Hannibal Lecter or a Psycho from Alfred Hitchcock's movie. Just these crazy psycho killers, basically. But that's not really totally accurate. A psychopath is simply a person that has no conscience. They feel no remorse. They have no what we would consider normal human emotions. They don't have any kind of warm feelings towards anyone or anything. They are totally self-centered. And the scary thing is that they're totally sane. What that means is that their thinking processes aren't deranged. They don't hallucinate. They don't they can live well in the world. They can adjust to the world. They're not crazy to the point where they should be in mental institutions.
They're very calculating, aren't they?
Very calculating, yeah. So they're manipulative, they're cunning. And
cunning.
They're so manipulative that they can appear to be a totally normal person. They can appear to be kind and generous and very charismatic, so people are automatically kind of drawn to them and drawn into their sphere of influence. But what's really going on is that they're using people. And one of the ways I like to describe it is if you imagine that there's something that you want in another room of your house, or something that you really want, and the door's locked, and you don't have the key, Well, you might grab an axe and chop through the door to get to whatever it is you need. Maybe you're starving, you need the food. Well, a psychopath has about as much feeling for a human being as we have for the door when we chop through it. So human life, pain, suffering, the trauma that people feel means absolutely nothing to a psychopath. They are totally ruthless, and they will do anything and everything to get what they want. And so that's essentially what a psychopath is. And
do they show signs of narcissism and so forth also? Is that sort of another characteristic of their personalities and so forth?
Absolutely.
Narcissistic types of personalities?
Yeah, they're total narcissists. So they really only care about themselves. They think they deserve everything, even if it's not theirs. So if they want it and it's someone else's, well, they deserve it more just because they're so great. And not only are they so great, they're always right. And they will lie and try to convince other people about their lies. So that's where you get things like what's called gaslighting. It's kind of the interpersonal version of Hitler's big lie or Goebbels' big lie, is that they'll make you crazy by telling you something that's totally not the truth, but with such conviction, and they'll just repeat it over and over again to the point where you start doubting your own version of events. So they might do something or say something, especially in a relationship, like a romantic relationship. They'll say something, or they'll do something, and then later on when it's brought up, they'll totally deny it. They'll even switch the scenario around so that you're the one that's done the bad thing, and it's really crazy-making because most people just can't comprehend that someone would lie like that. They think that they must think it's the truth, and if the person saying these lies thinks they're the truth, they must have a reason for thinking that they're the truth. So maybe I actually don't remember it the way it really happened. Maybe they're right. And it's that kind of insidious lying that not only traumatizes the person in a relationship, or in a societal example, you'll have a government that tells a lie. And we see that in the world stage today so often, that a government will tell a lie, and then the people will believe it, or they'll think, oh, well, you know, that might not be true, but they must have a reason for thinking that. So we see that a lot in the news, where we have, anonymous intelligence experts telling journalists that they have intelligence that this and this happens. So we saw it with the weapons of mass destruction with George Bush, and we're seeing it today with the alleged evidence of, Russia's involvement in eastern Ukraine, and with the downing of the Malaysian MH17 flight. But the thing is that this evidence never comes to light. It's just an assertion provided by some anonymous source. But the people will read that, and they'll see it repeated over and over again on the news and in the newspapers, and think, oh, well, they must have a reason for saying it, right?
Right.
Some evidence, right? And that's the thought process of a normal person, is that, well, if this person's saying this, they must have some kind of reason.
Right.
And, go on.
Yeah, these mainline media, they parade all these experts past us all the time, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And then they use that credibility of these so-called experts to sell the idea or the propaganda piece that they're trying to present to the public. And you're saying that there's a lot of psychopathic characteristics of the people that presenting the news that know better, or really they're trying to gain a certain goal and control over the public. So it's rationalized for power, isn't it?
Absolutely. And so they're looking for power. They've got an agenda for when they're doing anything like this. And what it comes down to in ponderology is that one of the main points that Lobachevsky makes in the book is that the main characteristic of these systems of government that we have and that we see in the past and in the present is that it's psychopaths that rise to the top. And there's a couple of reasons why it happens this way. One is that psychopaths, like you said, they're totally narcissistic. They want everything. They're they're kind of like greed incarnate. They want something and they'll go for it and they'll take it and they'll use whatever means whatsoever to get it. Now, one of the things that they want is power. And one of the reasons they want power is because if you look at a normal human society, or if we can even try to conceive of a normal human society that's based on some kind of universal human values and just things that make sense, like sustainability, and in terms of how we use resources, in terms of how we just run the basic day-to-day operations of governments, things that will actually work and that will benefit the people. Not this 1% disparity of wealth, you know, with the richest people holding so much of the wealth and the, you know, a majority of the people holding essentially nothing. If we look at how a society, you know, should be run sanely, in such a society, psychopaths can't get anything, really. Not only can they not accumulate way more than they deserve, psychopaths just don't have the same values that we do. Now, when I was describing psychopaths, I said that when we think of them, they're not necessarily these rabid serial killers. But the thing is that their inner thought processes, their worldview is totally different than a normal human being. When a person is kind of is exposed to what to a psychopath and what they really are, it's really a frightening experience to see just how hollow they are. And that's why true crime, either crime TV, like just TV shows that we see, or actual true crime, you know, accounts of serial killers, why people are so fascinated with them, because it's just so foreign to them. When you see what looks like a human being who can torture, like sadistically torture a person, and not only do that without vomiting or throwing up or, you know,
right,
or getting sick,
gosh,
but to actually enjoy it. That's how different a psychopath is from a normal human being, that some of these people actually enjoy it. And so when you start getting into this and you're looking at this idea, okay, so let's say we start out with the idea, okay, well, maybe psychopaths, you know, do get into positions of power. Now, this is kind of it's in the public domain these past 10 years or so, where we're seeing articles and books being written about psychopaths and oh, you know, maybe politicians will be psychopaths. Well, two of the experts, Bob Hare and Paul Babiak, wrote a book called Snakes in Suits, and it's all about how psychopaths get into the workplace in corporate environments, and how they kind of take over and rise to the top, and they'll use people and create situations so that innocent people will get fired, they'll take their positions, and they'll kind of rise to the top. And they'll just create havoc in these work environments in order for their own personal gain. Now, when we extrapolate that idea and we look into politics, and we think about the idea of psychopaths in politics, where they are in the positions of kind of the people with the most power, not only politics, but big business. Whenever you think about politics, you know, when I speak of that, I'm kind of talking about the power structure. So wherever that power structure is, whether it's in corporations or politics or, you know, lobby groups or whatever, when you think about psychopaths in those situations, and then you kind of start digging beneath the surface, one of the big events for me, one of the things that really made this click for me, was reading about cases like the Franklin scandal, the Franklin cover-up. Are you aware of that one?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, so with the pedophile ring that was during George H.W. Bush's presidency.
Yeah, John DeCamp. John DeCamp. Yeah.
John DeCamp wrote that one. And then a journalist, Nick Bryant, just wrote a book in the past few years, maybe it's about 4 years old now, on it as well. And that's a great book. I really recommend that one. It's called The Franklin Scandal. So both those books. But anyway, the idea of these pedophile rings, there was that one in the U.S. There was the Dutroux scandal in Belgium and France. And these pedophile rings scandals kind of pop up in countries all over. They've been popping up for the past 40 years. And there's just the most recent one, you know, that came out in the U.K. that's still ongoing after the Jimmy Savile scandal with the BBC, and it turns out that there's this dossier that they're looking into in the UK that lists you know, allegedly all these politicians that were involved in these pedophile rings. And the thing is, it's not just pedophilia. When you look into like the Franklin scandal, it's violent. It is there's murder, there's torture that goes on of the most innocent people in the world, of the children. And so when you look at it that way, there are psychopaths in positions of power that enjoy this kind of thing and that get away with it. And this is the point that I was trying to lead up to, is that in a normal society, they wouldn't be able to do this. You know, people would, if people were aware of this, these, you know, it's, if we just look at it historically, these people would be lynched in the streets. And they'd be locked up. Bad things would happen to them. They would not be allowed to do these things. And psychopaths know this. So we've got these two ideas. One, psychopaths are kind of totally different than normal human beings. They see the world totally different. They have totally different values. They think only of themselves, and they really love and get enjoyment out of some of the most horrific things that ordinary people can imagine. And they would be, and they know that in a normal human society, they would be destroyed, basically. And so what they want is they want a system of government. They want a world where they can do whatever they want and not be persecuted. You know, the scare quotes around that. They don't want to be persecuted for their values, which aren't really values at all. It's just depravity. And so what happens is that they get involved in politics. They worm their way into political ideologies and political movements, and they gain positions of power. And this happens on all levels of society. So you can see it from a family structure with a psychopathic dad or mom to, a business, a corporation, a school, a university, a big corporation. And we get into politics, a party, local politics. And then all the way to the top, where we have psychopaths getting together and getting to the top of these positions of power, to the point where they have such power and such wealth that they can do whatever they want with impunity. And that's really what we've been seeing when we have these hints of these scandals going on, and just the amount of corruption in the world, and, you know, the world's going to hell in a handbasket, and this is probably the reason and the explanation for why these things are going on.
Yeah, you make some good points there. What sort of comes to me very quickly is that we have a system of crony capitalism, and through that system, these people are networking with other psychopaths to bring them into their own networks and further each other's interests. But they have a monopoly on that money, and that helps feed that whole system in a very dark and black way. What do you think?
No, yeah, I agree. I don't think there's much more to say about that than the way you said it. It's insidious, and it's systematic, the way that they connect and the way that they use money. And it's really the money and the power that keeps them there. And it's really hard to see how things can change, without a total revamping of the entire system, because it is so systemic in the system that, I just personally, I can't see it changing very easily, unfortunately.
No, the worldly things are reinforcing, one of the ideas that I've come up with in the past is a false self type of a mechanism it's ego, it's I'm God, and when you're saying about that they'll do anything or any we're in these groups, it sounds like a system of Satanism to me also. What do you think?
Yeah, you could put it that way. I would say that, it's hard to say. I think there's definitely some weird stuff that goes on in these groups that you could call satanic. And but from the psychopath's point of view, they wouldn't call it that, of course, I don't think. For them, it's just everything else is, or all religions and things like that are just superstitions. So from their point of view, they're just doing what comes naturally. And of course, from a person, from the perspective of a person of faith, then yeah, that would appear satanic, and it's probably a good definition of it because it totally goes against everything that most people would consider to be good, and that would be some of the values that we find in religion. And,
right. Some of the people that have dealt with these psychopaths, they claim that there's an energy draining sometimes from them physically or something. And it sort of sounds like a parasitic type of dynamic at times. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I've heard that too. That psychopath, especially in relationship with a psychopath, it can be very draining. And it's almost this kind of supernatural element to it where it's kind of weird when you read about it. And psychopaths have this kind of like hypnotic gaze with their eyes. And it's almost as if they're there to suck the life out of you. And I know it's kind of speculative, but I'd say that there's some evidence for something like that. There's actually, the term psychic vampire, and I'd say psychopaths definitely fit the bill there.
What's the percentage in a general population Lavazeski come up with as far as the percentage of possible psychopaths in the general population, and how many of those would be men versus women, or is there an even distribution there, or what?
Okay, Lavazeski did do this kind of research and came up with some numbers for Poland, and I'll get into a couple issues. One is that if you ask the experts today, like the researchers into psychopathy, They'll say that the general population, about 1% of the general population, is psychopaths. Now, Lobachevsky came up with a similar number for Poland. However, one of the things that he pointed out that we need to keep in mind is that different countries can have different percentages. Some countries do have higher percentages than others of psychopaths. And so he said there was about 1% of the population that was psychopaths, but that there were 6% of the population that had other kinds of personality disorders that aren't psychopathy per se, but they're, maybe not as bad, but they contribute to the system. They can be pretty bad, and that would, that might include things that we would call like borderline personality disorder or narcissistic personality disorder or like clinical paranoia or schizotypical disorders. There are, all these kind of psychiatric classifications of people, so he said about 6% total with 1% psychopaths, but he said that number, that big number, 6%, could get into the double digits. So when we look at our culture and the researchers that say 1%, so basically 1 out of every 100 people is a full-blown psychopath, even that's a pretty big number, but really, we don't know for sure, because no one has done, it's really hard to do a study on a general population to get this kind of information, so they it's kind of like guesswork when they say 1%. I'd guess that it's higher than that, and I'd guess that in certain countries it's even higher than that. Personally, I think that one of the most psychopathic countries on the planet today is Israel, and just what's going on there, and you look at the politics there, it's just mind-boggling how wrong it is.
Yeah, there's some terrible things going on. As far as the origin of certain psychopaths, would you say that abuse as a child could create a psychopathic type personality, or would that be a causation or not?
No. This is one of the points that Lobachevsky is really clear on, and I probably should have mentioned it earlier in the show, that he's adamant that psychopaths aren't created by any kind of like childhood experience or abuse or anything like that. Psychopaths are born that way. And so you can have psychopaths born into totally normal families with no abuse. And in that case, they might just grow up to be really clever manipulators, especially if they're born into an upper class family. Instead of growing up to be, a gang leader, shooting people on the streets, they'll grow up to work in a bank and, you know, eventually, you know, become, you know, a CEO of something like J.P. Morgan or something like that, or, you know, a politician. So psychopaths can be born in any kind of family dynamic, in any kind of class division. So what you might have, like let's say you have a psychopath that is abused as a kid.
Okay.
He might grow up just to be a more violent psychopath, a more obvious criminal or something like that. But it won't make him psychopathic. You know.
Well, is he saying that a psychopath is one of the many personality types in? Is that what he's saying or what?
Well, kind of. He's saying that, yes, yeah, psychopathy is a personality type, but it's not a normal personality type. So he actually, he even thinks that psychopaths can be thought of as almost a separate human species. It's like we've got these two human species that look similar, but they're totally different. You know, on the inside, but, you know, by which I mean their worldview, the way they see the world, the way they process emotion and things like that. He calls them a different species. Robert Hare, who's one of the biggest researchers in psychopathy in the Western world, he calls psychopaths an intraspecies predator. So we basically, you know, other species have different species as predators. Our predator as human beings is a variety of humans that are called psychopaths.
Well, is it a collection of DNA that's different, or what exactly are they alluding to this type of personality being the, you know, the mix that causes this type of behavior? What are they,
well,
what are they saying there?
We really don't know at this point.
Okay.
Yeah, it's still a mystery. Lobachevsky thought it was certain genes.
Okay.
But we do know that it's highly heritable, so that so it isn't just acquired in childhood. But so far, no one has found a psychopathic gene. It may have something to do with gene networks, so all kinds of the genes working together. But really, at this point, that's still a mystery.
Okay, so they don't really have evidence like that.
No.
You know, in general, we've got all kinds of, like the cult of personality. Well, you know, you go to these, are psychopaths more prevalent in these collective societies and political systems than they would be in a more of a democracy, a democratic society, or what?
Well, if I understand your question correctly, I think that it's probably safe to say that psychopaths will be prevalent in any kind of let me put it this way. Psychopaths will be born in any society, so they'll be present in any society. Now, if we want to talk about the kind of factors that may kind of hinder them or
nurture them, well, totalitarianism, would that be a nurturing device, system then for psychopaths?
Well, I think that the most nurturing ones are are kind of this the way our society is structured now. Now, to give an example of a society that doesn't nurture psychopaths, I don't think that there's one on the planet today, but we do have anecdotes from certain, let's say, tribal cultures, like the hunter-gatherer tribes.
Okay.
Where because the social unit is pretty small, and you'll have tribes that maybe reach like 200 people tops. When everyone knows each other and when everyone interacts so closely with each other, the clues are a lot easier to see and the signs. And so there's a story about an Inuit tribe up in the north that they described a certain person or a certain type of person that would, you know, when all the rest of the men were out hunting and doing stuff, this guy would, stay back and try to sleep with the wives of the other people in his tribe, and basically a parasite. And they were essentially describing a psychopath. And so the researchers who were there asking them these questions said, okay, well, what would you do to a person like that? And they said, when no one was looking, they'd push him off the ice into the water.
Okay, so yeah, certain tribal traditions or methods, they get rid of these psychologically insane type people that are a threat to the tribe, right?
Yeah, no, they would.
Yeah, they get rid of them. Yeah.
Yeah, that probably wouldn't work in our society.
We would all have our eyes closed.
Yeah,
yeah, well, maybe it can, but in Texas, it's 100 degrees down here today. But anyway, we needed to break the ice a little bit, didn't we? Huh?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. This is a heavy subject. And, you know, you and your Red Pill Press and Linda Knight and everybody else, y'all do a really good job, you know, in putting forth some really good ideas and so forth, you know?
Yeah, no, thank you. We try, and we basically see the need for it, so we, you know, we work at it, and we try to get the stuff out there.
Yeah, yeah, you do a wonderful job, and there's so many good books there, and give us your website again.
Sure, it's SOTT.net, so SOTT.net. You can also check out our website for the publishing company, Red Pill Press. So that's just redpillpress.com, REDPILLPRESS.
Okay, I've got another question for you.
Sure.
Psychopaths go for the power, I guess, because they think themselves as God in a way or something like that. But, okay, in doing that, then, are they attracted, like, to secret societies and mystery school systems and things like that? It seems like it would be a natural fit for their operations, the way that they think.
I think so. Now, the way I kind of think about it is that I don't think there's any kind of really necessary link, like, that attracts them to kind of mystical societies or secret societies or anything like that. I think what probably happens is that, one, by their very nature, they will form what we'd think of as a secret society. Because one of the points that Lobachevsky makes is that psychopaths kind of seek each other out when they're engaged in this kind of political power seeking. They kind of form a network of psychopaths. And so, of course, that's going to be, you know, they're going to need some way of communicating and basically conspiring together to, in their own self-interest. Now, I think that probably whether it has something to do with the mysticism or not, I think that they definitely have, created or gravitated towards these secret societies. It's hard to say, you know, a lot of this stuff, it's hard to say exactly when it happened, how it happened, what's really going on. So I think it's a definite possibility, and I think they probably do get involved. I'm not sure exactly the reason why. It's got something to do with them seeing themselves as God or not, or whether it's just a kind of natural thing to get together in these societies. And who knows, maybe these secret societies started out, you know, with kind of good aims or good intentions, and then they were taken over by psychopaths. That's also possible, because that's what psychopaths do to kind of any political ideology. They'll basically worm their way in to something that has potential and that has support, and then...
Well, you know, one example of that might be when John Robison, who wrote Proofs of a Conspiracy, warned George Washington about the Illuminati taking over Freemasonry.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that work, but... from what I...
That might be an example of basically what you were talking about, where a real group like the Illuminati that maybe tend towards psychopathic behavior would say, well, let's go in and operate in a secret basis and take over these Masonic lodges. There's a series of letters that George Washington wrote after he was warned about this to several of his cohorts and colleagues, and they discussed this. There's about over 100... there's several articles. I don't know the exact number, but those can be there of record at the Library of Congress has those. So our listening audience can go in there and click on George Washington Illuminati, and up will come some of those letters.
Yeah, no, I'll check that out. But that definitely sounds possible, because like I said, that's the way they work. They infiltrate, they take over, and then they move things in their direction.
Right. There was a man, I want to say Huntington, that coined the term Davos man. Are you familiar with that term?
No, I'm not.
But the Davos, there's a meeting every year of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland.
Okay.
And he seemed to indicate that this Davos man was similar to what we're talking about, see? Very powerful, very, you know, influential, very rich, you know what I mean? People that have risen to the top. And basically we're talking about psychopaths that can do this. I mean, that they naturally tend to rise to the top. Whether in a political system or some kind of business corporation or whatever, you know. So that Davos man was, I think, coined by Huntington that wrote extensively in that area. I'm not saying that those people are all psychopaths or anything, but maybe we ought to start looking at some. And Nate, how about the Bilderberg Group?
Oh, yeah.
Would some of those people fall into this classification, you think?
Oh, yeah, I'd say so.
Huh? But I mean, it was over in Copenhagen on the last Bilderberg meeting, and we had a conference over there, a symposium, for a couple of days. And so we went down there to the Marriott and on the last day, and, you know, they were on their way out by then, but we had friends that attended most of the, you know, protest days. But, they can hide, a psychopath can hide this type of behavior very well, and you're saying in their relationships, do women or their love interest, do they ever wake up to some of this going on, or are they just caught up with them so much that they're dominated by them and they never get out of that those relationships? What's sort of the history on some of that?
Well, I'd say both. There's a great book that I recommend. Like, if everyone could read this book, it would be great, because it's great for women to read, like young women before they start getting into relationships, and it's great for guys to read too, because it applies to them too. It's called Women Who Love Psychopaths.
Okay.
And by Sandra Brown, and she gets into this exactly the issues that you're asking about. And the short answer is that yes, some women eventually will see, you know, a psychopathic partner for who they are. Could also go the other way around, because females. Oh yeah, I didn't answer your question about female psychopaths.
Okay.
I'll just get to that really quickly. I don't know
sure.
the exact figures. I don't know if the exact figures are available, but apparently, most researchers think that there are more male psychopaths than female psychopaths. Don't know the exact percentages.
Well, what I pulled out of the readings here is 10 to 1, maybe something like that.
Yeah.
10
well,
times possible. As many men as women in psychopaths or psychopaths. Okay.
It's also possible, some other researchers think that the numbers might be more equal, but that female psychopaths might get different diagnoses. They might be more often diagnosed as borderline personality or narcissistic personality, and that could just be the way that psychopathy manifests in females, because when you look at some case studies of female psychopaths, they will often use what are considered female traits more often, like as a manipulation tactic on other people. So they might now, of course, this will depend on society and the way society views women. So a female psychopath may act more emotional than she actually is in order to manipulate other people. So that might get her classified as like a hysterical personality or borderline personality because she's so emotional and kind of like crazy emotional. But really it's just an act, and she's just using that as a manipulation tactic. So that's a possibility. It's possible that there are a lot more female psychopaths than are currently thought, but that they just get diagnosed with other personality disorders.
We should give an equal rise to the female psychopaths, you know? We got to take away the glass ceiling for female psychopaths.
Yes.
So they can rise to the top too, right? Huh?
No. Yeah. And what were we talking about? I missed the
they can hide themselves very well. And we were talking about in relationships, it sort of evolved into relationships. And what I was going to say, too, was that these psychopaths then, to a degree, of course, you were stating some of the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, number 5 it is now or something, some of those different classifications of disorders, right?
Yeah.
But it looks like to me that one of the comebacks that the psychopaths have been using in the last few years, and they've stepped up their operations, and I see that they're starting these conspiracy studies in not only in Cambridge, but at the MIT, and they're planning articles in Time magazine in different areas, and they're talking about these conspiratorial people, and there's something wrong with them, and they're way off the base. So what they're trying to do, it looks like to me, the psychopaths operating from the top level are trying to do away with being uncovered by us, by the conspiratorial community, or patriot community, or truth community, however you want to describe us, you know,
yeah,
I guess,
that,
you know.
I think that is totally accurate. I think you're right on the ball there. Now, Lobachevsky has a chapter in his book called something to do with psychology and psychiatry in a pathocracy. So pathocracy is a system of government ruled by psychopaths. And he makes the exact same point you did, that in Poland, for example, the authorities controlled psychiatry and psychology. They controlled the sciences. But it was kind of more obvious over there. So certain subject matters, certain areas of research were off limits. So you couldn't say anything about psychopathy. You couldn't research psychopathy. You couldn't write papers about it. They blocked certain areas of research. And the reason they did that was because if these areas were advanced and if the knowledge about them was publicized, like you said, they would be exposed. People would have the knowledge to be able to diagnose the leaders and the system itself, and the system would fall apart because of that, because people would see what was really going on and what their weaknesses were.
There's a fellow that wrote a book called On the Causes of War, and he got a good chapter in there on intelligence operations, okay? And he seemed to come back down into the black operations, you know what I mean, area. And he seemed to insinuate that this is where you'll find your psychopaths in an intelligence organization. Because they had no qualms about doing anything to anybody. See what I mean?
Yeah, and when we look at the phenomenon of false flag operations, I mean, what kind of person would engage in a false flag operation where they'd kill their own citizens and then try to blame someone else for it? I mean, right?
Well, an example would be 9/11. If it depends on how you come down on that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I broadcast 3 international 9/11 truth conferences myself,
mm-hmm.
New York and Toronto and Vancouver. So I'm on the 9/11 truth side personally, you know.
Yeah, me too.
So and I'm not going to go off of that. I'm not going to be scared off of it or anything because.
No.
It's just too important, to try to make some sense out of what happened there. How about these dynamics now that are happening in North Iraq? That ISIS, ISIL, jihadists or whatever, are they really? This is some of the most savagery of action that the world has seen in a long time. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a pretty complex situation. From what I've read about it, I think the conclusion I've kind of come to at the moment is that these groups were funded in Syria by the West. So they're essentially, I think the U.S. and the Western, whichever Western powers helped to support these groups, bear a lot of the responsibility here for creating them. So I think that ultimately responsibility lies in the Western sphere. But I do think that when we look at ISIS just as a group for what it's doing, or I guess they're just called IS now, if we just look at them, then they're kind of a perfect example of just the rampant pathology that we're describing here. But just totally, there's no mask on it. There's no attempt to look sane or to look...
No, there's not, is there?
No. So it's just, I think that's one of the things about psychopathy is that when psychopaths will wear a mask of sanity. They'll try their best and be very successful at appearing to be totally normal and to be totally, not even just normal, but more normal than normal, and to be more moral than moral. They'll look like good people, and they'll look like they're trying to do the right thing, but only because they need people's support in order to keep on to their power, in order to people out of the positions.
Yeah, he says spellbinders. Can they be spellbinders at times, can't they?
Yeah.
Great orators or great speech givers, you know, speakers.
But then when they when you've got power, when you've got support, when you're in a country like Iraq, it's just, you know, the U.S. destroyed it, essentially, and just left it a pile of rubble. When you've got that kind of chaotic situation, it looks to me like they're what's the need of a mask at the moment, right? They can be as barbaric as they want to be because they can get away with it. So what we're seeing there, I think we're seeing essentially the same mindset that we have in our leaders. It's just over there, they're not wearing the masks anymore, you know, because they don't think they need them. But it's the exact same mindset. When you take away the religious overtones, like, you know, obviously over there there's a Muslim mindset, but it is, that's just the cover, that's kind of the mask that they're using, is that, a religious mindset, but really the barbarity of it.
To justify their actions, yeah.
Exactly. But the essence of the situation, the essence of ISIS, that barbarism, that's the same mindset that the leaders in the West have.
Right.
It's just that, you know, our leaders cover it up better with, you know, suits and ties and high words about spreading democracy.
Yeah, right. Hey, we've got about 2.5 minutes left. Any concluding remarks and so forth? And websites? Give us your final concluding thoughts.
Okay, well, I'll list the websites again. It's SOTT.net, S-O-T-T, and redpillpress.com. And I guess one of the things, one concluding thought that's an important thing is that psychopaths are in all groups. So whenever we put, whenever we make a minor distinction more important than a psychological one, that's when we get into danger. So it's not just, you know, Christian versus Muslim or Republican versus Democrat. If you view your in-group, like, let's say a Democrat or a Republican, if you view your group as the most important distinction, then everyone in your group is good. That's not going to be necessarily true, because you're going to have psychopaths in your group. And if everyone's better because they're a Democrat, or if everyone's better because they're a Christian, you're going to miss the distinction that makes the difference, the difference that makes the difference. So you've got, I think people really have to focus on psychopathy, on psychology, and realize that these people can be anywhere and everywhere. And that, you know, it takes time to analyze this, and you can't resort to simplified ways of looking at things, like, you know, left or right.
Yeah, one of the things that I can see is they go for power and dominance. So if you see a very dominant person that's grasping for power at all costs, you know what I mean? It would indicate that they're very ambitious, and they could tend to be psychopaths, if not just ambitious people, but, you know, the extreme behavior like that would indicate psychopathic behavior, seems like.
Exactly, and we have to be on guard for that no matter who we are and where we are. So, you know, it could be in our own families, in our own,
Next door, right?
Exactly, yeah.
I'm not psychopathic, my neighbor is. He's going to get him. Well, you know what, Harrison? I really enjoyed the conversation with you this evening. And, gosh, we broadcast, like I said, 7 to 9 every Saturday night. And we want to thank you very much for your time and all your important inputs and thoughts. But thank you very much, and good night.
Okay, thank you, George. Good night.
Yeah, good night.